It's always nicer to talk about pleasant things than trouble. But we've been given a lot of information in the scriptures to prepare us. And when we look at the chart of the ages, we see that the harvest of the gospel ages is the transition point between the kingdoms of this world and the glorious kingdom of our Heavenly Father and His Son. We're living in that time, and so naturally, we want to know how soon will all this end and the kingdom be established. I'm not going to stand here and tell you the year and the month when that's all going to happen for obvious reasons, but I will tell you that the Lord has given us signposts to know approximately where we are in the harvest. And we find some of those indicators in the book of Revelation, and in particular as we study the seven plagues of Revelation in chapters 15, 16, and 18. But before we look at that, that's going to be our subject for this morning. I'd like to begin our discussion with the words of the Apostle Paul in Romans 8, 18 through 21. And I'm going to read that from Phillips. Paul wrote, "Whatever we may have to go through now is less than nothing compared with the magnificent future God has in store for us. The whole creation is on tiptoe to see the wonderful sight of the sons of God coming into their own. The world of creation cannot as yet see reality, not because it chooses to be blind, but because in God's purpose it has been so limited. Yet it has been given hope. And the hope is that in the end, the whole of created life will be rescued from the tyranny of change and decay and have its share in the magnificent liberty which can only belong to the children of God." Isn't that an amazing text? I love the way Paul expresses that right at the beginning in the first part of verse 19, that the whole creation is on tiptoe to see the wonderful sight of the sons of God coming into their own. And the image that comes to my mind when I read that is of children straining to see over a fence that maybe is just a little too tall for them, and they need to find a way to boost up higher. They're on tiptoe trying to see what's on the other side of the fence because they think what's on the other side of the fence needs to be seen and is something very special. And you know, in the context of what Paul is saying, there is something extraordinarily good beyond what we can see. When the church comes into its own, as Paul put it, the time of trouble will end, the kingdom will be established with the resurrection beginning, and mankind coming under the rulership of finally a good and benevolent government. In Paul's words, mankind will be rescued from the tyranny of decaying things and be given liberty. Liberty from all sorts of things. Liberty from economic troubles. Liberty from man-made institutions that probably caused more problems than they solved. Liberty from evil. And of course, eventually, liberty from death itself and from the Adamic curse. As we look over the fence and we strain to see what's up ahead, you and I have a, have a great advantage. We have the binoculars of Bible prophecy. They help boost us up and focus on what the Lord is doing, especially during the harvest, so that we would be better prepared and know how to act when these things occur. Well, this morning we're going to look at the process that leads to the downfall of Babylon. And as I mentioned, that process is described in Revelation as the seven last plagues. And of course, whenever you're dealing with prophecy, there are multiple views amongst the brethren. But you know, that's something that we shouldn't be afraid of or intimidated by. In fact, it should be expected, because the Lord purposely makes prophecy difficult to see because he obviously doesn't want his enemies to understand exactly what's going on ahead of time. And so I think that we should be able to examine the various interpretations of Bible prophecy with an open mind and discuss them freely amongst ourselves. I'm going to present one viewpoint on the plagues, but there are several. There are at least three or four others. And I suggest if you have any interest in this, that you evaluate the scriptural strengths and weaknesses of each of the different views. The book of Revelation suggests that in the harvest, the Lord will not deal just with the sins of nominal Christianity, but through the pouring out of the plagues, he will deal with fallen man and the evil that he has created in society as well. Papacy, of course, is a central figure in the picture because she has claimed to represent God's kingdom. She claims to speak for God on the earth. And so that position places a greater measure of responsibility and condemnation on that institution because of the evil it's committed down through the age and through the many lies that it's told. But of course, the other systems of man, along with papacy, have also made God angry. And the plagues of God are described as the pouring out of his anger, his wrath. Well, let's begin by giving a broad definition of what we think the plagues are. A broad definition would be that they're an undermining and debilitating series of events ending with the final violent overthrow of nominal Christianity and civil governments. Now, I think most brethren would probably agree with that definition. But where the brethren tend to differ is on the timing of the plagues. Again, I won't take time to elaborate on the various views. I'll leave that up to you. But the timing that I think is the most scriptural begins the plagues at the beginning of the harvest. In 1878, to be specific, although we won't deal with that date in particular. And that the plagues are a progressive series of events that began then and are continued to be pouring out. And they continue to have an effect, each plague, while each other plague is being poured out. And then the seventh plague will have its full impact on bringing the systems down in the final violent overthrow, crash of Armageddon. Now, I'm going to approach this maybe a little differently than you might expect, because the seventh plague appears to be the most obvious to define. We're going to start at the seventh plague and maybe work our way back to the first. And then we're going to go, like I said, go back to the first plague, because I think we can also more easily pinpoint where the first plague begins, and then we'll try to fill in the middle ones. The seventh plague is described in Revelation 16, verses 16 through 20. And this is the New American Standard. It says, "And they gathered them together to the place which in Hebrew is called Armageddon. Then the seventh angel poured out his bowl upon the air, and a loud voice came out of the temple from the throne, saying, 'It is done.' And there were flashes of lightning and sounds and peals of thunder. And there was a great earthquake, such as there had not been since man came to be upon the earth. So great an earthquake was it, and so mighty. The great city was split into three parts, and the cities of the nations fell. Babylon the Great was remembered before God to give her the cup of the wine of his fierce wrath. And every island fled away, and the mountains were not found." Now, right from the beginning of that verse, we see that the seventh plague is the final battle of Armageddon. And we've determined from our studies, particularly of Armageddon, that it immediately precedes the establishment of the kingdom. That final battle, you can spend a whole session studying what Armageddon is, but the final battle is described in the Old Testament, particularly in Ezekiel 38 and 39, is Gog and Magog coming down against Israel to take a spoil. And then Zechariah says this. He says, "For I will gather all nations against Jerusalem to battle, and the city shall be taken, and the houses rifled, and the women ravished, and half the city shall go forth into captivity." And then the very next verse says, "Then shall the Lord go forth and fight against those nations as when he fought in the days of battle." The Battle of Armageddon, the seventh plague, as shown in Revelation 16, will be the final transition phase between trouble and the peaceable kingdom. And so it appears that the end of the plagues is pretty clear, and that obviously we're not there yet. So having defined the seventh plague, I think we can also go back and define where the first plague begins. So if we know where the ending is, and we know where the beginning is, it should be a little bit easier to understand what the middle plagues might consist of. Now, I think we can know with some certainty that the plagues began right near the beginning of the harvest. To find that marked beginning, we go back to Ezekiel chapters 9 and 10. Those of you who heard my last discourse on Ezekiel's vision, you know where I'm going with this. But I have to briefly review it because it helps us get a handle on what the first plague is. Because I believe that Ezekiel pinpoints the beginning of the destructive work and the plagues. So there's a real help in pinpointing the beginning. You probably recognize the ninth chapter of Ezekiel because it's the reference to the man with the writer's inkhorn. To understand how Ezekiel 9 relates to the first plague on spiritual Babylon, we really have to know what's happening in the early chapters of Ezekiel. At the beginning of the eighth chapter, the prophet Ezekiel is taken in a vision to the city of Jerusalem, and the temple in particular. And in that vision, the Lord shows Ezekiel some of the abominations that the Israelites were committing. He shows them the idols and the pagan worship that had been brought into the temple courtyard. And then he led Ezekiel to the entrance of the temple proper, and he shows him women weeping for Tammuz, which was a pagan idol. And finally, the Lord brings the prophet into the inner court, and there he saw 25 men facing the sun and worshiping it with their backs to the temple of God. And of course, God was very angry at that. Idolatry is a bad thing, but to be brought into the very temple of God made it especially despicable. God was angry, especially because of who was committing these sins. These were not pagans. These were Jews. They preferred to worship stone idols and images, even the sun, right there in the temple courtyard of Jehovah. Of course, these people had a greater responsibility for these sins than any other pagan nation, and that's really what they have ended up being at that point. And so that's the context of what precedes chapter 9. And then in chapter 9, God gives a prophecy of Jerusalem's destruction. He says that he would send 6 men with destroying weapons, and among them was this man dressed in white linen who had a writer's inkhorn at his side. And his assignment, this man with the writer's inkhorn, was to go around the city and mark the foreheads of those who mourned over the abominations that were being committed in Jerusalem. And once that marking was complete, then the 6 men with destroying weapons could do their work of destroying Jerusalem and the temple. So that's a very brief summary of Ezekiel 9. And so when we look at that, we see that there was a very immediate fulfillment in Ezekiel's day that can be seen in the ministry of the prophet Jeremiah. If you study Jeremiah chapter 21 and chapter 39, the Lord is talking about the destruction of Jerusalem. And in that context, he directs Jeremiah to go around the city of Jerusalem and warn the people of what was coming and tell them that if they wanted to survive, if they wanted to be faithful, they had to leave the city. And so you can see how his ministry there, assigned by God, paralleled the work of the man dressed in linen in Ezekiel 9. And then the 6 men with shattering weapons, they correspond to the army of Nebuchadnezzar that came and laid siege and finally destroyed Jerusalem, but not until Jeremiah had done his work. So what does this have to do with the 7 plagues of the gospel age harvest? Well, there's an important clue given to us in Jeremiah. Jeremiah 25:10. It helps us make the connection between the prophecy of Jerusalem's destruction and the destruction of nominal Christianity. Let's read that in Jeremiah 25:10. And we'll see why it's such an important verse in connecting this Old Testament event with the New Testament prophecy. Now, the context here in Jeremiah 25 is preceding the destruction of Jerusalem. And then God says, "Moreover, I will take from them the voice of joy and the voice of gladness, the voice of the bridegroom and the voice of the bride, the sound of the millstones and the light of a lamp." Now, again, in this context, we're talking about the destruction of Jerusalem at the hand of Babylon. So it's still the Ezekiel 9 picture with the 6 men with destroying weapons coming from the north. But this verse gives us a clue to the gospel age connection. Did that verse remind you of anything that you've read many times before? That verse is the connection, I think, that we need to Revelation. Notice it's almost the exact wording of Revelation 18. This is Revelation 18, verse 21 and 23. It says, "Then a strong angel took up a stone like a great millstone and threw it into the sea, saying, 'So will Babylon, the great city, be thrown down with violence and will not be found any longer. And the light of a lamp will not shine in you any longer, and the voice of the bridegroom and bride will not be heard in you any longer. For your merchants were the great men of the earth, because all the nations were deceived by your sorcery.'" So you see the parallel between those two verses? In Jeremiah, we have a more abbreviated description of what was lost by Israel. Jerusalem would no longer hear the voice of joy and gladness or the voice of the bridegroom or the bride or the sound of a millstone or the light of a lamp. Well, those are some of the exact same things we read in the Revelation 18 account that spiritual Babylon would lose once it's thrown into the sea. And I think that's telling us that the destruction of Jerusalem at the hands of Babylon was a picture of the destruction of nominal spiritual Israel, with papacy being a main component part of Babylon. Some of the symbology used in Revelation, I think, supports the picture that we see in Ezekiel of the man with the writer's inkhorn who's going around marking the foreheads of the faithful. Remember in Revelation chapter 7 what happens to the faithful who leave spiritual Babylon, and how this is in contrast to what happens to those who partake of the first plague in Revelation 16:1. Remember, in Revelation chapter 7, we're told that the four winds are held back until 144,000 are sealed in their foreheads. Well, that's a special thing. That sealing of God in the foreheads of 144,000 shows their approval of their life and consecrations by God. But look at the contrast in Revelation 16:2. We're told that the first plague caused a malignant sore in the people who had the mark of the beast and who worshipped his image. What a contrast. The saints receive the mark of God, while those with the mark of the beast receive a malignant sore. It's a direct contrast between the true and the nominal. The true will be blessed in the harvest by receiving the mark of God's approval. The nominal have to deal with the malignant sore that will lead to their death as tares. None of us wants to be a tare. So attaining the mark of God is a vital goal for each of us in the harvest. Just as Jerusalem's abominations caused God to become angry, so the plagues are God's outpouring of God's anger towards institutions that brought idolatry into the worship of God. Revelation 15:1 says that the plague in the plagues is filled up the wrath of God. Okay, you might ask, how does that help pinpoint the beginning of the plagues? Remember, that's the point I wanted to make in bringing up Ezekiel chapter 9. Well, if the seven men in Ezekiel 9 picture the seven plagues in Revelation, as we're suggesting, then we see that the first plague has to be the work of the man with the writer's inkhorn. It's the harvest message. It's the Lord's work done through a special messenger. This plague is unique from the others. It's the beginning. It's the relevant message of the harvest. It's the calling out the faithful. As we look at the work assigned to the man dressed in linen, we see that the Lord actually gave him two things to do. First, we saw the Lord, through his ministry, was to mark the foreheads of the faithful. And second, if we study Ezekiel chapter 10, we see that the angel of the Lord gives him coals of fire. And he's instructed to scatter these coals of fire over the city of Jerusalem. Fire is a symbol of destruction. And so this scattering pictures that Jerusalem was condemned by God and it was going to be destroyed. The fact that the man dressed in linen is the one who scatters them over the city suggests that the harvest message would proclaim that the nominal systems were doomed, that God has weighed them in the balances, and that they were going to be destroyed. You know, that message was a vital part of Brother Russell's ministry. You cannot read the second, third, or fourth volume without understanding that Babylon has been judged and will be destroyed. And so we ask, well, what practical effect has the harvest message had on nominal Christianity? And I guess I would put it this way, very simply, when saints leave the systems are weakened by that. Jesus described the saints as a salt of the earth. And if that salt, that preserving quality of saints, has taken out the nominal systems, then that standard of righteousness that they held is also removed, and the system is diminished. You know, the harvest message has been around for about 100 years. It's been heard by millions of people. The truth about the man of sin must of necessity have had a debilitating effect. That's why the harvest message is the first plague. It expresses God's judgments and begins the process of tearing down. So we identified the last plague as Armageddon, and we can now see, I think, that the first plague is probably the harvest message. It gets things rolling. So I wonder, how about plagues 2 through 6? Where are we in the process of plaguing Babylon? And I'll tell you, it's a little more difficult question to define the middle ones, as specifically as we had the last and the first. And of course, one of the things that makes it difficult to identify specific events that correspond to each plague is that the description of each plague is very brief, usually only one verse. And so I guess we'll just have to say we'll try to identify the other plagues. We can only offer some possibilities. There's just not enough detail to be absolutely sure we know what plagues 2 through 6 are. But let's give it a try. Let's go to plague number 2. This is Revelation 16:3. And again, notice the brevity of the description. It says, the second angel poured out his vial upon the sea, and he became as the blood of a dead man, and every living soul died in the sea. Well, we know in Revelation that the sea is a picture generally of restless humanity. And because of being one of the very early plagues, this is most likely a description of World War I. Now, World War I caused the death of some 16 million people. Germany lost 15% of its male population. Austria-Hungary lost 17%. France lost 10%, 10.5% of its male population. About 750 German civilians died from starvation caused by the British naval blockade during the war. Diseases flourished in the wartime conditions in 1914. In 1914 alone, lice-borne typhus killed 200,000 people in Serbia. I mean, these are astronomical numbers that we're probably sheltered by because of the time that's passed. And World War I had residual effects after the war ended. Now, best estimates of the death toll from the Russian famine of 1921 say that there were from 5 to 10 million people who died in that famine. By 1922, there were between 4.5 and 7 million homeless children in Russia. As a result of nearly a decade of devastation from World War I, the Russian Civil War, and the subsequent famine that followed. Now, on a spiritual level, World War I caused Europeans to lose faith in their own institutions, especially Christianity. What good is Christianity in the light of such a terrible war? Where is God in all this? And so all these questions grew to undermine people's confidence. This also made the work of the previous centuries by godless philosophers such as Friedrich Nietzsche and Karl Marx more popular than ever. Now, Nietzsche was a German philosopher who challenged the very foundations of Christianity and of common morality. In fact, during the 1930s, some of Nietzsche's philosophies were espoused by Hitler and some Italian fascists. The work of Karl Marx you know very well. They inspired the birth of many communist regimes in the 20th century. And, of course, Darwin's theory of evolution undermined the authority of the Bible. And because of that, Christianity is less believable and less desired in the world. Evolution purported to be based on science. And so it became very appealing to secular minds as an alternative explanation to the record in the Bible. The increased influence of these misguided philosophers grew out of the loss of faith in institutions that resulted from World War I. World War I also removed the long-standing support from the royal houses of Europe. You know, we often sing, the kings have had their day, right? And our king is marching on. And that was true as a result of the war. The royal houses of Europe were essentially gone after World War I. And so another pillar of support was taken away from papacy and Christianity in general. Now, in addition to these effects of the war, one other important thing evolved out of World War I. Let me quote an article written by a famous Bible student. This is written by Brother Carl. He wrote, "A direct outgrowth of World War I was the establishment of investigative reporting as a standard journalistic practice. As these reporters began disclosing the hidden machinations behind the war effort, some sincere theologians began reexamining old creedal concepts and challenging them. The effect of this two-pronged plague was to further remove creedal fences and leave the mingled and confused religious people defenseless." You know, we still see that very prominent today, don't we, in the ongoing effects of investigative reporting and the scandals among the papal priesthood. These revelations have further undermined people's confidence in the church. So we can see this undermining effect that World War I has had on Christianity and on society in general. It was likely the seventh plague that described as a sea turning to blood. And then the third plague is described in Revelation 16, verses 4 through 7. It's really only a one-verse description. There's just a little commentary given. It says, "And the third angel poured out his vial upon the rivers and fountains of water, and they became blood. And I heard the angel of the waters say, Thou art righteous, O Lord, which art and wast and shall be, because thou hast judged thus. For they have shed the blood of saints, and thou hast given them blood to drink, for they are worthy. And I heard another out of the altar say, Even so, Lord God Almighty, true and righteous are thy judgments." Well, here in plague number 3, the rivers and fountains of water are turned to blood. A river of blood obviously cannot sustain life. And so this is something that at one time was able to give life, but during this plague loses that ability. Well, following World War I, the next major world event was the Great Depression. The Depression caused some 25% unemployment in this country. You know, our economy today is struggling with just under 10%. Imagine what it would be like with 25% unemployment. And on top of that, the 1929 stock crash caused stocks to lose 40% of their value. Foreclosures and bankruptcies were at an all-time high. Many farmers couldn't keep up with their payments, and they lost their farms. And then many others turned to living on the streets because they just couldn't afford the payments on their homes. It's beginning to sound familiar, isn't it? It's almost a retracement or prophecy of what's happening today. The Depression was also compounded by a devastating drought that came to be known as the Dust Bowl. It lasted for about 6 years, from 1930 to 1936. It was so devastating that the clouds of dust blown off dry fields were so prevalent that the dust from Oklahoma and Texas could be seen in New York and Washington. The economic waters of the world were unable to sustain life. They became as blood. Wikipedia says that the Great Depression caused a sudden and general loss of confidence in the economic future. There's a recurring theme of that losing confidence in the systems. This was likely plague number 3. Let's go on to plague number 4. It says, and the fourth angel poured out his vial upon the sun, and power was given unto him to scorch men with fire. And men were scorched with great heat, and blasphemed the name of God, which hath power over these plagues, and they repented not to give him glory. Well, the next world event, the major world event that came, of course, on Christianity and society, was World War II. While World War I saw the death of some 16 million people, there were 70 million people who lost their lives in World War II. Now, the description I thought was fascinating there. We're told that this plague gave power to scorch men with fire. And so by that vivid description, you wonder if that could be a reference to the atomic bomb that finally ended the war with Japan. The plague scorched the earth with great heat. I think that might be a significant clue for us. The timing seems to fit, at least the way we're applying it. And then on a spiritual level, World War II caused the further increase and rise of existentialism. Now we're back to the growing philosophies of men like Nietzsche and Marx. Existentialism says that you are responsible for your own life and giving meaning to your life. It's a very secular and anti-God approach to life. It has had a very unchristianizing effect on society, as it has largely abandoned Christian principles and concentrated on self. The withering of Christianity escalated in Europe as a result of the war. Again, in the light of such devastating events, why is Christianity relevant anymore? World War II also contributed to the rise of the Soviet Union as a world power. You know, I saw a documentary recently, and it said that one of the reasons that England entered the war was to allow Poland to be a free democracy. Under Hitler, it obviously wasn't. And then after a long, bitter war, Poland wound up under the thumb of Joseph Stalin, who in every way was as evil and wicked as Adolf Hitler himself. So what did the war accomplish for Poland? In fact, the documentary concluded that really World War II did not end for Poland until the Berlin Wall came down. So our Polish brethren might attest to that, those who can remember back to World War II, that it was not much better under Stalin than it had been under Hitler. So 20th century communism has virtually destroyed Christianity in Eastern Europe. Well, there are pockets, and there are brethren there. But for the most part, society in general has become very atheistic in those countries. In fact, communism has also led directly to the death of almost 100 million people. Those numbers are just almost impossible to comprehend. Now, we've seen the degenerative influence of World War I, killing so many million people, followed by the general loss of faith in institutions, including the institution of the church. This then opened up the way for the influence of worldly philosophers who preached against God and against religion and pushed society more towards a secular view of life without the need for religion. Economic fear and distrust of government followed in the Great Depression. Secular philosophies such as communism were further enhanced with the amazing devastation of World War II. So that brings us up to Plague 4. Now we're Plague 5. Plague 5 says, "And the fifth angel poured out his vial upon the seed of the beast, and his kingdom was full of darkness. And they gnawed their tongues for pain, and blasphemed the God of heaven because of their pains and their sores, and repented not of their deeds." Now this is a very interesting one. Many brethren feel that this is a description of Vatican II. Vatican II was a council first convened in 1962 by Pope John the 23rd. It lasted for a number of years with a number of gatherings and decisions. It was called to address the influence of theologians who wanted to modernize the church. In other words, they wanted change. They wanted to change the way the church did things and bring it up to date. And even Catholics describe Vatican II as a revolutionary event in the history of the church. For example, now these may not seem real powerful to us, but to Catholics they were. For example, Vatican II changed the way the Mass was said. In the U.S., the Mass was now in English, and the presiding judge now faced the audience and made them part of the service. Under Vatican II, papacy changed their view of Protestants and Jews and even unbelievers, and now they call them separated brethren. And I think that's going to be a contributing factor in Plague number 6 when the beast, the dragon, and the false prophet come together. This is kind of laying the groundwork for making that acceptable in the eyes of Catholics. As a result of Vatican II, eating meat on Friday was also acceptable. And again, you think, well, what's the big deal about that? But this change resulted from the pressure of American bishops who wanted to make this change. Not eating meat on Friday really is what distinguished Catholics from other Americans. But now there is no distinction between them. And so in the minds of the people, these immutable laws of the church were mutating. They were changing. And so in their minds, they're wondering, what's going to change next? Were the old rules wrong? And if so, how can we know if any new rules that come from Rome are valid? First, the Mass changed. Now, eating meat on Friday has changed. And even though many wanted the changes to come, the very fact that changes were necessary implied that what the church had been doing for centuries had been wrong. The fact that Rome could now be challenged by American bishops also sent a message that Rome maybe isn't so infallible after all. You know, birth control was also an issue that many of the priests wanted to discuss at Vatican II, but for some reason the Pope removed it from the agenda. For some reason, he didn't want to address that issue at all. But as a result, modern Catholics have largely ignored the Church's position on birth control, and they just simply do what they want. This is an interesting quote. Andrew Greeley, he's an American Catholic priest, he said, "When the Pope turned down the recommendations of the lower orders regarding birth control, the people had already made up their minds. It was this development more than any other that shattered the authority structure." This is a Catholic priest saying that Vatican II shattered the authority structure of the church. That is a key point in why Vatican II may have been one of the plagues. Notice also that this plague was poured on the seed of the beast, and they gnawed their tongues with pain. Well, the seed of the beast represents her authority. And so this plague demonstrates how Vatican II, even though they were trying to do good things, undermined the authority of the church. New Albany makes a very interesting suggestion about that last phrase, that they gnawed their tongue in pain, that phrase may be God's subtle humor in referring to the controversy over saying the Mass in English or Latin. Which language do they use? There's confusion. There's gnawing of tongues. So, fifth plague is likely Vatican II. Now we get to where I believe we are on the plague timeline. And it's interesting that the sixth plague has the most thorough description of any of the others. And I wondered if the reason for that is because now at the sixth plague, we're nearing the end, and the Lord wants us to pay very close attention to what he's doing. Let's read that. This is verses 12 through 16. It says, "And the sixth angel poured out his vial upon the great river Euphrates, and the water thereof was dried up, that the way of the kings of the east might be prepared. And I saw three unclean spirits like frogs come out of the mouth of the dragon, and out of the mouth of the beast, and out of the mouth of the false prophet. For they are the spirits of devils working miracles, which go forth unto the kings of the earth and of the whole world, to gather them to the battle of that great day of God Almighty. Behold, I come as a thief. Blessed is he that watcheth and keepeth his garments, lest he walk naked and they see his shame. And he gathered them together into a place called in the Hebrew tongue Armageddon. Of course, the first thing we see in the plague is the drying of the great river Euphrates. And that takes us back to the Old Testament. You remember how the ancient city of Babylon was captured. The Euphrates River flowed right through the city of Babylon. And it was the Persian king Cyrus who had his army divert the waters of the Euphrates and then under the cover of darkness climb under the walls and capture the city. And I read an interesting fact that the Babylonians had anticipated something like that, and they had these gates on the outside of the wall and on the inside of the wall. But because Cyrus chose to attack on a certain festival day, that they were very careless, and those gatekeepers were probably drunk from partying, and the gates happened to be left open on the night that he came under the walls. So that was an interesting providence, I think, that the Lord provided. We're told in Revelation 16 that the river dries up so that the way of the kings of the east might be prepared. I think, well, who are those kings of the east here? Well, in the context of ancient Babylon relinquishing its role of universal dominion, we see that it was probably the combined nations of Media and Persia that took over from Babylon. So the kings of the east was probably the co-regents, Darius the Mede and Cyrus the Persian. Now, there's some evidence as to why this cooperation worked so well. There's some evidence that Cyrus was actually the nephew of Darius. So there was a cooperative relationship until the death of Darius 2 years later, and then Cyrus the king, the great, became the sole king of the empire. Now, Cyrus is a very interesting person in biblical history. He's mentioned a few times in the scriptures, specifically by name. In Isaiah 45, it says, "Thus says the Lord to his anointed, to Cyrus, whose right hand I have held, to subdue nations before him and loose the armor of kings, that you may know that I, the Lord, who call you by your name, am the God of Israel, for the sake of Jacob my servant, and Israel my chosen one." Now, it's interesting that God would call a Persian king his anointed. Of course, the word anointed means Messiah. So in some way, Cyrus was going to be a Messiah. And the book of Daniel gives us some details about the overthrow of ancient Babylon. The last king of Babylon was Nabonidus. But because he spent most of his time away from the city of Babylon, his son Belshazzar ruled from the city of Babylon. And that's why Belshazzar becomes such a prominent figure when we look at Daniel, the fifth chapter. And so as Cyrus marches troops towards Babylon, we're told in the fifth chapter of Daniel that Belshazzar held a long, large feast with his lords and wives and concubines in his palace. And he feasted and he drank wine. And finally, he had the idea of bringing the gold and silver vessels that Nebuchadnezzar had brought from the temple in Jerusalem so that he and his party could drink out of the vessels from God's temple. It says that they drank the wine and praised the gods of gold and silver, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone. And of course, as this was happening, all of a sudden the fingers of a man's hand appeared and wrote these words on the wall of Belshazzar's palace. It says, "Mene, Mene, Tekel, Upharsin." I'm sure you recognize that. But when Belshazzar saw that, he was so afraid that we're told that his face grew pale, his hips went limp, and his knees knocked together. And he called together his nobles and his wise men and his astrologers to interpret the writing, but they didn't know what it meant. And when she heard about what was happening on Belshazzar, on his wall, it was happening in the party there, his queen came in, and she reminded him of the wisdom of Daniel, how he was skilled in interpreting dreams. And so Daniel was brought in to give the interpretation of what was happening here. Now, the literal translation of Mene, Mene, Tekel, Upharsin is this. Mene means numbered, Tekel means weighed, and Upharsin means divided. Numbered, numbered, weighed, divided. And then Daniel gives the interpretation in verses 26 and 27. He said, "This is the interpretation of the message. Mene, God has numbered your kingdom and put an end to it. Tekel, you have been weighed on the scales and found deficient. and Perez, your kingdom has been divided and given over to the Medes and Persians. So Babylon's days had been numbered. Babylon was weighed in the scale of God's justice and found unfit to retain universal dominion, and so it would be divided amongst the Medes and the Persians. And that very night that Belshazzar saw this handwriting on the wall, he was killed by Cyrus's army. In Revelation 16, we read that the Euphrates was dried up to prepare the way of the kings of the east. And we said that in the case of ancient Babylon, this was likely Darius the Mede and Cyrus the Persian. This is what Brother Shalhoub says about that and how he interprets it. He says, since the invasion of Babylon by Cyrus and his army is clearly alluded to in verse 12 of Revelation 16, and since Isaiah 44:28 and 45:4 speaks of King Cyrus as Jehovah's servant and as his anointed, as his Messiah anointed, it is reasonable to conjecture that in the Old Testament account, Darius represents God and Cyrus typifies Jesus. The remaining kings of the East picture those associated with Christ as his glorified church and body members. I like that. I think that's right. So the drying up of the Euphrates will prepare mankind for the coming mediatorial reign of Jesus and the church as God's representatives. The handwriting on the wall of Belshazzar's palace was a picture of God's judgments against spiritual Babylon at this end of the age. Just as Belshazzar drank from the holy vessels of God's temple, so papacy has profaned the worship of God by worshiping saints and relics and statues and other things. In fact, I heard on the news this morning that the papacy has just declared that there are six more saints. And for the first time, there's a saint mentioned from Australia. I thought, gee, I wonder what the Australian brethren think about that. They finally got a saint. They've never had one before. And Cheryl said, well, you get to be saint for a day in the Catholic Church. But in God's true way of doing it, you get to be a saint for eternity. We're not making fun of them. We're just saying that what they've done is wrong and needs to be dealt with by God. And so it too has been weighed in God's balances and will be destroyed so that the reign of a truly righteous king can take its place. This is the beginning of the end. The sixth plague is going to prepare the elements for plague number seven, that will finally be the overthrow of Satan's empire. Now, did you notice when speaking of Cyrus that Isaiah said that his works was for the sake of Jacob my servant and Israel my chosen one? In other words, the reign of Cyrus was going to benefit Israel. And so it did. It was a decree of Cyrus that ended the captivity of Israel in Babylon. Their cruel treatment of Israel was one of the reasons that Babylon had been found unfit to continue reigning. Now a new king, favorable to the reestablishment of Israel, would be brought in because Israel's captivity was now nearing an end. And under Cyrus's influence, Israelites would return to their land and rebuild Jerusalem and the temple. And of course, that is one of the works of the antitypical Cyrus in the harvest. Israel is being rebuilt so that the kingdom can be administered through it. But it will be fully established after Babylon is destroyed and the antitypical Cyrus takes his full power over the nations. And so as we get back to the sixth plague, we see that it sets the stage for Armageddon, the time when Israel will be delivered and made God's central authority on earth. Now this idea of the drying up of the Euphrates, the general thought is that the drying up of the Euphrates represents the withdrawal of support for Babylon. You know, like we said, the Euphrates River was the life source of the city of Babylon. What is the life source of Christianity and society today in general? Well, it's twofold. It's public support and it's also money. If either of those are withdrawn, the system doesn't work. Now, in the sixth plague, the waters are dried up. And so people are withdrawing their support from the churches and from governments. And as we saw in the Great Depression, there may be this economic component to the drying up of the Euphrates. And if that is part of the picture, that there's an economic picture there, then we are experiencing that partially today in the current economic downturn. Now, of course, most economic downturns sooner or later turn back up. And ours looks like there's a chance that it's going to recover. But eventually, there will be no economic rebound as the Euphrates River is dried up. And so that's something we need to know about so that we can be prepared and know how to deal with it and how faith enters into when those times happen. As a result of the drying of support and the financial withering we see during the sixth plague, three entities speak with a common voice. Now, in our studies of Revelation, we've seen that the beast is a picture of papacy, the dragon is civil governments, and the false prophet is the amalgamation of Protestantism. In Revelation 16:13, we're told that three unclean spirits like frogs come out of the mouth of the beast, the dragon, and the false prophet. And then in the next verse, verse 14, we're told that they are the spirits of devils working miracles. So now, in the sixth plague, because the systems are failing both financially and for the lack of popular support, we see a cooperation of religious and civil powers. The cooperation and collaboration between them is purely for their survival. It's not because they necessarily like each other. And out of their mouths come three unclean spirits like frogs. And that description seems to suggest that it's the sounds of croaking that comes from the mouth of these three entities. And a frog croaks for a number of reasons. First, it's trying to attract a mate, and then it croaks to protect its territory. And you wonder, could that be what the beast, dragon, and false prophet are trying to do here? In a sense, they're mating. They're trying to become one. They're trying to survive. And second, because of the plagues, they're trying to protect their territory that they've had for centuries. Now, in order to croak, you've all seen this picture of a frog taking in this air, and it inflates the skin underneath its chin. And when it inflates it like that, it creates a resonating chamber, they call it, and the sound is amplified. So out of this little slimy little creature comes this loud croaking sound, much louder than you would think a little animal could make. When these three powers start their croaking, it will be with a great air of power and authority, much greater than their actual power would warrant. But notice that what comes out of their mouth is three unclean spirits. That term, unclean spirits, may suggest demon involvement, even possibly demonic miracles or materialization. We don't know. But the fact that the Lord would put that phrase in there may be a warning for us to know what may be coming and to be prepared for it. The Apostle Paul may be referring to this when he says in 2 Thessalonians that the Lord's presence would be accompanied by the increasing work of Satan with all power and signs and lying wonders. We've already seen the rise of demonism in our day, but as this plague grows, it will increase to the point where people will be deceived by it. We're told that the beast, dragon, and false prophet will then gather the nations to Armageddon. You think, well, that seems a little strange. Armageddon, we said, was the final battle in Israel that we mentioned earlier. Why would these three powers, struggling for their lives, gather the kings of the earth to Armageddon? And I think that suggests that Armageddon may be more than just the final battle in Israel. It suggests that Armageddon really will have a worldwide effect in bringing an anarchy into the world. And also as a distraction for its own troubles, it says, let's go get Israel. Then notice that the seventh plague is poured out into the air. Satan is the prince of the power of the air. So this may have something to do with Satan and the fallen angels. It could possibly be the restraining of the fallen angels. We can't be sure, but it seems to be related to the unclean spirits mentioned there. But then notice after plague seven is poured out, it says it is done. You think, well, what is done? Well, it could be the end of the church's career, similar to when Jesus was on the cross and he said, it is finished. This could be a clue for us to say that at this point, the church will be complete. Or it could be a reference to the final binding of Satan. I guess for that one, we're going to have to wait and see. But whatever it means a blessing for mankind, because what follows is the final collapse of Satan's empire. Following that proclamation, we're told that there are flashes of lightning and thunder and a great earthquake. And then in verse 19, we're told that the great city was split into three parts and the cities of the nations fell. There's the three parts. There's the beast, dragon, and false prophet. Now they're divided. They're broken up. And they will finally be destroyed there in the seventh. So let me give you a quick summary of what we've described as the seven plagues. First, we saw the plaguing effect of the harvest message sent by our Lord through Brother Russell. Then we saw the effects of World War I, socially and philosophically. Then the Great Depression drained confidence in economic matters of the world. Fourth was the devastation of World War II and the continued buildup of these secular philosophies in the minds of man. Then Vatican II eroded confidence in the seat of the beast, and currently there is this gradual withdrawal of moral and financial support from the systems. And lastly, Armageddon, the greatest time of trouble this world will have ever seen, will bring on its wake the kingdom of God. So as we see the debilitating effects of the plagues and the world events that they portray, the question is, what are we to do about this? How are we to live during the most troublous and chaotic time in human history? And I found it very interesting that right in the middle of the sixth plague, about where we are today, I think, the Lord says, "Blessed is the one who stays awake and keeps his clothes, so that he will not walk about naked and men will not see his shame." In all the prophetic talk about plagues and trouble and distress of nations, the Lord remembered to give us one last admonition. Stay awake to what the Lord is doing. Keep studying not only the fundamentals, but prophecy as well. Keep our garments unspotted from the world. And that means living our lives in full devotion and service and trying our best to grow in Christ's likeness. If we do these things, we will have the mark of God on our foreheads and we will be safe in our Father's loving arms no matter what evil happens out there. You know, at the beginning of the talk, I asked how many of us would like to know how soon will this all end and the kingdom be established, because that's really what we want. And the answer is soon. If we are seeing the effects of plague number 6 now, then plague number 7 cannot be far off. And if plague number 7 is not far off, then the kingdom is not far off. Today the economy is crashing, demonism is on the rise, the tensions in the Middle East are escalating, anti-Semitism is increasing, and Israel finds itself more and more isolated. How much longer can it be when we see all these things happening? Now, close by repeating the words of Paul that we opened with. Whatever we may have to go through now is less than nothing compared with the magnificent future God has in store for us. So, brethren, you know, we don't like to talk about these terrible things coming, but look beyond them. Look over the fence. Stand up on your tippy toes and see what God has in store beyond the trouble. Because what he has beyond the trouble is worth going through the trouble for. It's going to be so grand and glorious. May the Lord guide us and help us to worship him in spirit and truth. And may the plagues accomplish their work and usher in the glorious kingdom that we all long for.